ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman Report. Each and every Tuesday night in the third hour, we are joined by Stan Deo from standeo.com. Bookmark that site and go there. Each and every day, you can check out their photo of the day, their video of the day. Holly does a great job of putting all the important news that's up there. And you also have the show images page, which is on the right-hand side. Underneath the YouTube icon, you can click the show images page and follow along with the images and research Stan has put together when he comes on our show each and every Tuesday. And as always, it is fascinating. We get into a number of issues, earth changes, earthquakes, the hurricanes, to stuff that's going on in the Middle East, prophetic stuff, biblical stuff, as well as I see today we're going to be talking a little bit about solar wind and solar flares, and a number of other things. There's been a lot of activity since Stan has been on the last time. So we will jump right into that. We're still waiting to try to get Stan on, so we will take care of that. Eric, is that a... I know you don't get Stan on. That's a... Is it just... Ah, okay.
So I think I'm here.
We just need to wait to set something up. That's the computer lingo I get. Do we have Stan? Just need to set something up.
Testing 1, 2, 5.
Great show again. Daniel Horowitz was just on, and that was a fantastic segment, fantastic hour. Really getting into the inner workings of what is happening in the world of politics between the Democrats and the Republicans, and kind of looking at some things that could be done and are not being done versus what are some solutions that will prevent these politicians from getting in the way with this government bureaucracy and this swamp. How can we circumvent that and take the agenda that the American people want to implement and get it behind the right person and implement that? We do have Stan Deo with us. Again, folks, standeo.com. From there, you can bookmark the site, then go to the show images page and follow along with us. Stan, it's great to have you back.
Can you hear me now?
Not loud and clear.
Good. All right. Yeah, good to be back. There's a lot of things happening, as you know, and we'll cover a few of them today. You've seen the show images page. What grabbed your fancy first?
Well, you know, since we last talked, there was a, what was it, an 8.2 earthquake in off the coast of Mexico that left a few dozen, I think a dozen people dead. There were the fears of this big tsunami that didn't happen. But the earthquakes was one thing that I see you have a number of graphics up for already. The solar flares. We had a number, we're in the, and Stan, you can explain this much better than me, we're at a solar minimum cycle. And we're getting X-class solar flares.
Yeah, normally the sunspot cycle peaks out and you have the maximum number of sunspots during that period of time, usually a 2 or 3 year period. Now for this sunspot cycle, it's the 24th, we are now at the downside of it, almost the low side of this current cycle, as opposed to being at the high side when we have all these sunspots and hence coronal mass ejections and flares. We shouldn't be seeing the flares that we're seeing now, and it's the attending coronal mass ejections. This is unusual, and it's not over yet. In fact, there's a link on our website there on today's thing about Image 56, I think it is. It takes you over to what's called the Solar Ham amateur radio station, right? And they gather all the data that is pertinent to, you know, solar wind, which affects radio transmissions and reception. Now, they've been taking a note of these things, and you can see on the left-hand side of that, if you click on that image and get to solarham.net, you can see the top 10 flares, and two of them have occurred in the last, 4 weeks. You know, and the others were back in 2015 and 14 and 11, but we've had two in this same month, you know, within 4 days of each other, the 10th and the 6th of September, which is highly unusual.
I think that was X3.2 and an X8.2, number 2 overall and number 7. I believe, if I remember the...
Well, number 1 is X9.3.
9.3, right.
And 1 is 8.2, which, you know, occurred fairly close to the Mexican earthquake. Now, when these happen, depending upon where the Earth is in the stream of solar wind particles that come out from the sun all the time, it can affect our weather rather quickly, adding energy into the electromagnetic field through the poles, and then hence heat into various portions of the ocean and the air. I was concerned, seeing this happen, that it might affect the hurricane, Irma down at Florida. Whether it did or not, I don't know, but certainly the damage is done from that hurricane. So keep an eye on this page. As I say, it tells us a number of things, and one of them is the when you're on that page is the pattern of the solar wind. And if you go down the page on the left, you'll see some colored pictures. One says global D-layer absorption in the atmosphere, and then CME prediction models. And if you click on the right part of that CME prediction model thing, you'll see like a spiral. And that gives you an idea, looking at that, how the, in fact, click on the second image on that there, which shows an animation of the spinning solar wind as it passes the Earth, which is the yellow dot in this circle. And that passing solar wind at the moment is where that red and white density is. So we're getting a blast of stuff which will pass us in the next day or so. But visiting this page frequently will keep you up to date on where the solar wind particles are the most dense and where we are relative to them. This is something that my research team and I follow fairly closely as we're researching ways to produce electricity for the home from atmospheric electrostatic waves created by the solar wind, the vibrations that on our upper atmosphere. We're just continuing the research of Dr. Morey back in 1935 or so. Anyway, this map tells us a number of things. If you look down, go at the top of the page of Solar Ham, and on the right-hand side, you'll see a bunch of little squiggly lines, blues, orange, and yellows in a graph on the right underneath the pictures of the sun. And if you click on that, it will give you a view of a number of things. One of them in blue there called the phi factor, the phi degree. And what that is the angle at which the solar wind is hitting our planet from 135 degrees up to 360 or so, it shows it there. And the major activity is hitting us at an angle of about 135 degrees rather than straight on. You can see by the little blue dots there. And the speed, which is right now, the speed is picking up. It is at about 650 kilometers per second, it looks like, in that yellow graph down there. These things all help us to calibrate our own tests and the frequencies we're looking for on a broad spectrum analyzer. That's just technical talk for what we're doing anyway. But it's interesting, and I think people should have a look at that.
Absolutely.
There are a number of articles that you can link to off of the news about the solar flares that the sun has been producing and how abnormal that is. I think, as I've been kind of warning all along, we're going to see an increase in coronal mass ejections and solar ejecta and particles being emitted from the sun as it goes through a phase state change. If you'll look at the show image page, go back to that now. Let me just find the link to that. Image 54. If you click on image 54, it'll take you to an article that NASA has on its site. Now, in 1992, I was down in Australia, of course, and I was talking by phone to an Air Force officer in charge of measuring the ionospheric status, you know, of the upper atmosphere, the charge and wind velocities and stuff from the solar wind. And there, I got a direct report from that officer saying, okay, look, in 1992, we started noticing these, early this year, they were saying, we started noticing two new frequencies coming from the sun in the ultraviolet range. And so I filed that away in my mind, and years later, I started looking for it, trying to find the report of that. And that report has kind of been buried somewhere. But NASA has come out with this page I linked to there, showing that over the last 30 years, there's a little graph there, and you can click on it. It's got a purple graph. And you click on that, and it shows the percentage of change in ultraviolet coming from the sun. And it doesn't say what frequencies, but I'll tell you right now, it's in the frequency range of emit the same kind of radiation, the same frequencies, you know, as a constant, you know, relatively constant. But these are significant changes in the output of the sun. So that tells you we cannot blame a lot of the warming and effects that are like called global warming on people and animals and plants. It is on the sun itself, and this is on NASA's site. There is no question that the alleged global warming by, you know, cow gas and whatever is a farce. It is not based on true science. This is it. And when you can get NASA to be able to release that information, that's good. And so click on that that slide 54, go mark that article, and read it, you know, after we're off air or whatever. But it does give you a lot of hard data to prove this. And, of course, as I was saying in slide 57 above that, in our solar cycle where we are now, this is very unusual to have this many solar flares and other kind of minor magnetic spots in the low part of the solar cycle. I'm going to be quite interested to see what happens in the next few months. I think we're going to see more surprising activity from the sun.
Yeah, you know, Stan, that's very interesting, and it'll be interesting to see when those findings are published by NASA, how they try to spin that, because I guarantee it won't be won't have a headline on it. You know, something's off with the sun or different with the sun. Don't blame man-made climate change. They're not gonna roll out with that. Did you guys see the article today that talked about they want to continue to push for laws to punish man-made climate change deniers by giving them fines and whatnot in America?
Yeah, I know. Well, apparently, not only Steve Quayle and Alex Jones, but our website and about 397 others have been put on the Google Watch list as, our website, as, you know, purveyors of things that are not the standard accepted science. And, you know, I don't know what that means they're going to do, eventually shut our sites down or deny us in the search engines or whatever. We've already been seeing some evidence of that in the number of people that actually get through to our site. We count them by day, and it's dropped. So,
and we're there too, Stan, not only in our website, but also our YouTube channel is ranked separately under the YouTube section of that report. And, I mean, we know what you mean. The one thing that bothered me about that report, and I know a lot of our listeners don't know what we're talking about, was that there were some sites that didn't seem like they belonged on there. Sites that were much more liberal and mainline, know, right up the Obama stuff. It just real weird that a few of the sites that were on there, most of them made sense to me that I knew, but there was a few that didn't seem like they belonged. But anyway.
Well, I sent an email off to the people that wrote the article, and I asked them, I said, look, if you don't mind, can you tell me how you calculated us, the 400 of us or so that are on the Google list? Because when I put in a search for our website, whatever comes up, the first thing on the top of the page. But there must be something that they're doing that they are allowed to, that these people that did the report could put into their search and say these sites are being hit by Google. Strangely enough, I got some Google ad stuff. I paid whatever was $25 a month for it here a couple months ago. And all of a sudden, we started getting more visitors back to our site. And I'm thinking, surely it's not some kind of an economic pressure that Google's putting on us. And if we buy Google AdWords, that, you know, they leave us alone. But it is funny that once I did that, then our hits started to pick up a bit.
Yeah, you know, we've been part of the, I know what you're talking about, Stan, and our website traffic, it's really funny because they'll say, you know, some days, I just don't trust the numbers. I'm not going to get into all the minutiae of all the numbers that we see that disappear, that, you know, drop the pages down, that take views away, because we see that stuff all the time. I mean, YouTube is all but crushed us from being able to generate revenue on their platform. And we used to do pretty good generating revenue, and not a lot like some of these other YouTubers are doing, but it was substantial enough that when it was taken away, it hurt. And we have not been able to recover that no matter what we do, because they continue to disallow ads to be put on our videos. And then in my experience, even when they don't take the monetization away from you, they still don't show the ads on the videos, meaning there's no, since they've you know, came after us and demonetized and censored all of our videos, basically, from advertisers. There has been no growth since then, and I think that's what they really want. They want people to be so, and thank God for the listening audience that we have and the supporters and investors that we have, because without you guys, it wouldn't be possible for us to do this. And I think that's one area that they were looking for, YouTube was looking for, and Google also, was to be able to, well, if we can take their revenue sources away, they'll go away. And maybe that wasn't as easy as they thought it would be.
Yeah, I know. I just stopped trying to monetize the things because they hit me with so many things. Oh, this is a copyright violation, and then you get that cleared up, and then, you know, all of a sudden the number of hits to the thing drops down. You know, there's something going on in the background. Obviously, they want to stop the Christian, you know, conservative presence on the Internet. We're really the only kind of basically factual news source that's there. And if you talk about the earth is round instead of flat, you'd think that would be a good thing, but even that kind of stuff is censored. So you got to go with the accepted scientific thing, and the earth has been this diameter all the time. It's never been smaller, and the universe is 15 billion years old and not much younger. You know, you can't even have these discussions. It's censorship extreme.
Yeah. Well, no, Stan, it's not just that. Remember, when it comes to, you know, climate change and, what's Darwin, evolution, this is, according to Obama, these are settled sciences, right? I mean, the science is settled.
Yeah.
None of you ever known that to be the truth with anything, but anyway, it is a joke the way they are, these same companies who, by no accident have the most, you know, liberal, globalist, you know, Marxist people who will run them and are intermingled with the government are the ones who control now the information that is disseminated over the Internet. It's pretty unbelievable.
It's really like Fahrenheit 458 to Booby, or like 1984. We're there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a little late, but we're there.
Yep.
Hey, and along those lines, yeah, you know, I watch earthquakes, as do a number of other guys that study earthquake patterns and try to forecast things. Slide 43, if you click on that, it will zoom into an article. Earthquakes continue in southeast Idaho, but exact number is hard to pinpoint. Now, this comes from the Idaho State Journal, you know, news item. Now, I was watching the earthquakes at Soda Springs. We talked about last week and the week before. And at that time, I was well over 1,850 earthquakes that I got off of USGS, you know, 1,850. And it went over 2,000. And now all of a sudden, no, there's only about maybe 380 earthquakes that have occurred in this latest, you know, swarm of earthquakes there. It's hard to be exact about the number because of mining and various other things. But yet, from their own site, we had thousands that occurred there. And they just have disappeared it. You know, you go and look at their search engine now, it's not there anymore as far as your thousand. But that is kind of altering the data.
You know, I've been very fascinated by the stuff that you've presented about Yellowstone and the magma chamber and the movement and the earthquakes surrounding it. And it's still fascinating, Stan. I mean, I'll have to go through and read this article. From IdahoStateJournal.com, earthquakes continue in southeast Idaho, but exact number is hard to pinpoint. Wow.
What a bunch of it. Go down to, let's see, maybe it's 37, 38, 39. There's three of them. One's earthquakes for the year in the lower 48 USA for 2015. The next one is for the same thing in 2016. The next thing is to this year up to the 12th of September. And it looks like we might have nearly 1,960 of them, so by the end of the year on the basis of what we're seeing. But look at image 37 first, blow it up, and you will see that in 2015, there were a number of earthquakes in the New Madrid fault line that was 3.5 or over 3, Richter 3.
Mm-hmm.
There were four of them, okay? And then you look up near Yellowstone on the left there where the little yellow lines for seismic events are, you know, the fault zones. And you'll see that there were several kind of biggish ones around that area. Now then you go back to the next slide a year later, And you'll see there's only three in New Madrid. But there's still more up there along Yellowstone and Idaho and down the Rockies, down toward southern California, and kind of an arc. And then we'll go to the next slide, which is slide 39. And this year, already, we have five over Richter 3 in the New Madrid zone. We have quite a few up in Montana and down in Soda Springs, which is that orange dot there, and a number of them in the western side of Yellowstone. I forget the name of the exact center.
Stan, before you jump into what you've seen in this, I just want to ask you a question. If you're looking at where the New Madrid section on this map is, where 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are in that yellow zone, to the right of that, it looks like there's four earthquakes somewhere near southern Ohio, Pennsylvania border, maybe West Virginia, in that area.
Yeah.
There was only one there the previous year, and then the year before that, there was none. Do you think that's something like fracking? Is this just being between? Because they're in a pretty blue zone, and I know that can happen, but there seems to be some overlapping ones there.
You know, I don't know. Normally with fracking, you'll have a bundle. Look at this year's plot.
Yeah, in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, I mean, you know, maybe it's because there's so many fracking positions there. But in the area you're talking about up there, you know, in Virginia, West Virginia, that area, that, you know, there might be four in that I see. You kind of got to wonder whether that's really earthquakes or something. It's just a new fault opening up. I don't see it as a pattern.
Okay.
And look over to the left. I mean, you know, the Western United States, you could draw kind of an oval shape, football shape, around the Northwest United States and see that these swarms that we're having are outlining instabilities in the Rockies, going right on down to the west side of Yellowstone and down, heading toward Nevada and then into Southern California. Now, I keep kind of stressing, I think we're seeing development of major stress releases somewhere along that line and leading to the San Andreas and the Imperial Fault Zone south of Los Angeles. It might even connect across to Los Angeles from the San Andreas. So keep an eye on these things. What we're seeing here is the development of some patterns that are definitely new. That's why I put the 2 years before type plots. And in that vein, up at images 40 through 42, I looked at, let's look at number 40, which is a graph I did today, analyzing the amount of seismic energy released per month in earthquakes in the lower 48 states for the last... what was that, about 11 years, a little over 11 years?
It goes back to 2006 to January 2006, yeah, till now.
And you'll see that in around 2008, we had a lot of seismic energy released in that period of time. Now, the little black line in that curve is the mean, if you wish, the trend line, which uses a polynomial equation to the sixth power to estimate where it's going now on the right side of the graph. And you can see that they're estimating that the amount of energy release will be greater based upon the rolling average there. When I say the amount of energy, you know, if you get a Richter 6, that would be 10 with, or, you know, 1 with 6 zeros behind it. If you get a Richter 7, that's 1 with 7 zeros behind it. It's a factor of 10 increase, not just 1. You know, from 6 to 7, you think, it's an increase of 1, you know, Richter, right. So that's not a big deal. But it's actually 10 times the energy. So I actually went and calculated every earthquake in that period of time and converted the magnitude to the actual amount of energy it released. Now, from that, you can see that back in 2008, we had some significant releases of energy through the year, early and toward the latter part of the year in December. Now then, we are at kind of above average where we are in this year, and it may be that it's going to be greater. Again, forecast on a statistical average using a polynomial equation. Go to the next slide, 41. Are we at break yet? Close.
Stan, we are gonna skip this break and just continue on, unless you want to take it.
No, that's fine. Okay. All right, let's go to that next slide then, to slide 41. And this one is just the magnitudes versus the energy. This is the magnitudes from which I was able to plot that first graph I was showing you in the same time period from January the 1st, 2006 until September the 12th this year. And the red line is, again, the trend line on the magnitude of the earthquakes occurring. And you can see, sure enough, down there that 2009 had more magnitude values occurring, you know, on a daily basis than 2008, yet the energy released in 2008 on that former graph was much greater. Where we are now on the right side of the graph, you can see it's starting to climb up above the point where it was at the beginning of the graph in 2006 as far as the magnitudes of the quakes that we're seeing right up until today. It's on an increase. And then the third graph, graph 42, just shows the numbers of earthquakes by month. It doesn't tell you the magnitude, just the numbers of them. And you'll see that for 2008, the number was on average of about 75 per month at maximum, a small little peak. You get to 2010, wow, we had a bunch of them, but not so much energy. They're a bunch of small ones. Where we are now on the right side of the graph, we're at kind of a mean average for the whole period. So the numbers are versus the energy and the magnitudes are different stories, but put all three of those on there because they are, each tell a different story about what our quakes are doing.
Okay. That's very interesting, Stan. I've never done a computer graph like that, but I got some numbers I'd like to look at. I wonder, yeah, maybe I have to sit down or Eric to show me how to copy and paste data from USGS and implement it into a program that spits you out a graph like that.
Well, Excel.
I've noticed for about 10 years now, there is a, I would call it an irregular amount of earthquakes with a magnitude of 10 kilometers or 6.2 miles.
You mean in depth?
In depth, yes.
Right, yep.
And I think, I mean, I've been following this for years, and it seems like half the earthquakes, and I think I asked you about this before, Stan, and you said you weren't sure, but it could be something like a, just a number given, at first until they have more information, or, but I went back and looked, and a lot of the quakes are still listed at that depth, and I just wonder if there's some reason behind it, if there's something at that depth that, who knows what I'm thinking. I just spotted to me what looked like an anomaly in the numbers, seeing that number repeat constantly while reading earthquake data, and I thought it was kind of strange.
Well, it they do it by band. You know, they fall within that band rather than the exact depth. And, you know, it, they may vary by a kilometer or so, but they're basically they're within the 33-kilometer depth from the surface down for, you know, the majority of the quakes that we see. But at, say, on the West Pacific, you know, the Ring of Fire, when you get some that are down several hundred miles deep, you know, then those are very deep events happening on plate tectonic borders, whereas the shallow quakes can occur, you know, as surface ground movements and little, they're like usually more devastating effects when they're strong, but in essence they're like a ripple compared to these deep earthquakes that occur. And I personally think the deep earthquakes along, say, the west coast of the United States are things to be watched. They're telling you when, you know, the pressure between the two plates slipping over each other, one over the other, is reaching a point where it suddenly releases a large amount of energy deep. Then that tells you we may be close to the big one on the surface. It may shake the heck out of the surface. You don't want to see strong, deep earthquakes on our fault lines along the coast there. But anyway, okay, that's something we can have a look at. In essence, to answer your question, you know, from 0 to 33 kilometers, they're somewhere in that range, is kind of just a band of depth that they put it into rather than giving, you know, 29.5 kilometers versus 33.
Okay. No, I appreciate that insight, Stan.
Yeah. There's a lot. Hey, you know, weather stuff. Holly was telling me today, I had a look at it, that they were this lightning storm that occurred over San Francisco about
1,200 strikes or something.
1,200 lightning strikes to ground, but another 5,800 in cloud to cloud and internal cloud discharges. 7,000 in total in that storm. That's impressive. if you look at slide 46, yeah. 47, you can see that one shows 5,800 lightning flashes in cloud, and the other one shows 1,200 that actually hit the ground. There are so many pictures on it that the news story on it, you go to slide 48, and you can click on to the news story, and they have, I think, about 53 images that people have sent in, because everybody was, you know, amateur photographers were taking time-lapse photographs of these lightning flashes. And I thought, wow, that's neat. I would like to have been there to see that. And then on the other hand, maybe not. Yeah, Holly's laughing at me, but that's... Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, I do. She says, I stand out on the porch when we have lightning storms here with my camera. Yeah, yeah, I'll get that one. I'll get these. But there in San Francisco, it's interesting because if you look at slide 43, I went to that website, Null Wind, whatever thing, that lets you plot the currents of the ocean and the air currents at altitudes and various things like that to look at hurricanes. But you can also configure it like I have here, where you're looking at ocean currents and you're looking at sea surface temperature anomalies, you know, anomalous sea surface temperatures, and you can run it back and forth in time. You can, you know, run your date back, you know, a long way. And what I did here was just on the 10th of this month, right when all this stuff was happening with San Francisco. Now, that little green circle there is right outside the, you know, San Francisco Bay there. And I noticed that the temperature was over 3 degrees centigrade above average for this time. And out away from shore, where the blue is, it was a half a degree centigrade lower. Now, why is this interesting? Oh, you know, about 3.6 degrees, 3.5 degrees centigrade difference. 2 degrees centigrade on a global average is enough to throw us into an ice age. But temporarily, what this does here is generate a horrific weather machine, a thunder and a lightning storm machine, because of these differences of temperature and because of the circulating currents. You can see those little kind of gray lines are showing the circulation patterns off the shore there, off the shore of San Francisco. All these things combined made a perfect environment for an electrical storm that was impressive. And I don't think this is the last one we're going to see. It may not be at that point, but you have to watch these thermal variations in the sea, and that'll tell you a lot on the coastlines about where storms are going to generate that are horrific. I've been telling people this for years, as you know, that as we enter into this period of solar change, that the extremes in the climate are going to produce extreme drought, extreme rainfall, hurricanes and tornadoes, and, of course, extreme thunder clouds and thunderstorms. And we're starting to see that happen now very rapidly. Slide 44 right next to it. And
Stan, if yeah. I could real quick, while we're on the West Coast there, talking about San Francisco, did you see the microburst in Santa Barbara that happened last week? There were all these people on a beach. There was a few videos of it, but it uprooted palm trees and... I mean, it left a lot of damage. It looked like a tornado or a hurricane roared through there. And if you watch the video, there's all these people on a beach, maybe 100 people on a beach, and all of a sudden these violent winds come and, you know, start knocking over trees, you know, grabbing their umbrellas from the beaches, and people are starting to grab their stuff and run. But it was what they call a collapsing thunderstorm, they say, that created these huge microbursts. And in this one area of Santa Barbara, just tore up a whole bunch of stuff, like a F1 or F2 tornado had come through there. It was pretty interesting. If you get a chance, check it out.
I'll check it out. I know that we're expecting more of that kind of thing. Even Ed Dames, when he was on Coast to Coast years ago, in fact, I talked while we were doing a video together out there in Hollywood, and he said we're going to see more of these microbursts as we get closer to the what he called the warning shot from the sun, a particular event on the sun. The kill shot, he calls it. And even at that time, there'd already been a microburst that had hit in the mountains of northeast United States, somewhere there, which had cut a swath of pine trees, just chopped them off like a scythe had come through there. The microburst had winds of up to 200, 250 miles an hour. And
yeah, wow.
If you look at this program here, this Null Wind program here, I forget the exact name of the URL, but you can find it on my site, but look at that at the altitude where the pressure is almost zero at the edge of space to our atmosphere, and you'll see 200 to 250 mile an hour winds. So it's like in one of the movies we saw where all of a sudden those winds, by some circumstance, are forced down to the surface, bringing cold, high-speed winds, which just come down. And, you know, it's like maybe what hit the woolly mammoths with their meals still in their mouth, and they got quick frozen from these high-altitude, high-speed, cold winds that just drop down like, you know, a freezer on top of them. So I think it's important to watch these things. Now, look at the next slide over. I'm still going on San Francisco.
This is pretty interesting. The CO2 carbon dioxide concentration at surface.
Yeah. Yeah, you see, it's all along the coast there, from San Francisco down to L.A. and slightly south of L.A., with strong concentration of carbon dioxide at the same time that we had that offshore cooling and heating onshore. And this vortex shows you the wind pattern, prevailing wind pattern, blowing that stuff all along the coast. When you blow hot air and next to cold air, you're going to generate, it's like a Van de Graaff generator, you're going to generate some huge voltages and, you know, strip off ions of one cloud and cause them to short and make the lightning. Of course, I guess this is a great argument for global warming due to CO2, but in this particular case, it added to a natural event that it just intensified it. And the next image over 44 shows you the temperature gradient there at San Francisco and inland at kind of northwest, be Nevada area and the southern Baja region. The red shows the temperature was heightened there at the surface. And the streaks, of course, show the pattern of that vortex offshore. Now, that vortex is big, so it wasn't a hurricane, but it was certainly a vortexual phenomenon in the Pacific off the coast there. When you put all those three factors together, you get what caused that lightning show there at San Francisco. And I've seen a number of, you know, the sci-fi movies. One of them recently was about some effect from the sun, I think, directly, that generated lightning strikes on the surface. I forget the name of the movie. It's one of those B-grade movies. But this is kind of what we're seeing here, is due to solar heating. And we've had these flares, and we've had the CME and the energy added to our atmosphere. We're seeing this terrific bunch of lightning strikes, and I think we're going to see a lot more of them.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting how you broke that all down and showing the different components that make these conditions right for this to happen. That's very fascinating, Stan.
Well, look, I try to share how I do it and why so that people can go on and do that themselves during the week or whenever to keep an eye on developing conditions around where they live or where relatives live. So you've seen the footprints here, so if you see them again somewhere, then realize that something bad is probably about to happen. Do you ever go to that geoengineering site, that guy?
Geoengineeringwatch.org, Dane Wigington. Yeah.
Yes. I support what he does. I've emailed him, told him I really think he's done a great job of showing how geoengineering has progressed from the early, well, the 1972 until now, and the treaties involved. I mean, you know, you can see the various things if you look in the government site, even for the treaties, the weather warfare treaties that were signed and ratified in 1978. To prevent certain types of weather warfare, but it didn't cover everything that could possibly be done. I just put that link up in case you hadn't put it up for your listeners to go see that. A rather interesting event. Yeah.
And I think Dane's coming up. Dane's going to be on. He's been a guest before. He's going to be on in the next few weeks. I can't remember if it's this Friday or next Friday, but he is coming back on. So
that's an exhaustive research site. I just think it's just really great research, you know, my hat's off to him on that subject. It's really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Where did you want to go next, Dan?
Well, slide 51 first. This is about an asteroid that's going to come near the Earth the 12th of October. We've talked about this before, but when you click on the picture, it takes you to the article, the catalog of Earth satellites, and shows you high Earth, mid Earth, and low Earth orbit satellites, right? Now, the high Earth and geosynchronous orbits, that's one. ones that stay on the same place over the Earth's surface. These are used for communication, satellite, you know, GPS, and radio and TV and stuff like that. They're around 36,000 kilometers, which would be roughly 27,000 miles, 25,000 miles. And you, when you see this, okay, you think, well, okay, we've got whatever it is, 380 satellites up in that area, no big deal. There's 165 geosynchronous ones in that area on the western hemisphere. On the eastern hemisphere, up above us, there's 87. And to the left of slide 51, slides 49 and 50, I've got a PDF that you can download, which I pulled off of the Internet, which tells you which satellites certain countries have put up into orbit, in stationary orbit, at least the ones that they're willing to make public, right? And you look at how many things could be affected if one or more of these were affected by an incoming asteroid or meteor shower that hit a few of them at once. Now, usually asteroids don't come by themselves. They have a lot of trailing debris. And what they're saying for the 12th of October one is it's going to dive down into the geosynchronous satellite orbital band. It's going to be somewhere in the midst of all these, you know, 200 and some odd known high-altitude geosynchronous satellites, which could hit, you know, direct TV, could hit telephones, it could hit GPS, military, the Milstar satellite constellation, all kinds of stuff. And why am I concerned about this? Well, I don't know. Gee, it might create chaos on the surface of the Earth for some time if it impacted or changed the orbit of some of these satellites. You see what I'm saying? It's they're not playing it up, but this is definitely a situation to watch.
Where does the ISS, is that not in the same orbit classes?
No, it's lower. It's okay. You know, a few hundred miles above us. But, you know, we have several threats to the astronauts, normally, you know, radiation and micrometeorites, things like that. But putting them down close in the atmosphere or the upper atmosphere like that, which is very thin, it still gives them a modicum of support as far as, you know, tiny particles coming their way. A lot of them are just vaporized and don't hit the ISS. And let's face it, to hit the ISS or to hit some of these high orbit satellites, even pinpoint dust, particles traveling at these, you know, 30, 40,000 kilometers per second speed, these things are so far apart, you know, the particles, that it is kind of a random and very low probability that they will actually hit or impact any of these satellites. But I still feel that it's, you know, I don't want to see them do tests on that particular asteroid to move it out unless they can move it out long before it gets into our upper atmosphere or upper orbital band there. I just think it's risky. But then that's just me. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's definitely interesting. October 12th. Something to keep your eyes on. Because who knows? Who knows what could happen?
All right, now.
Hopefully nothing, though.
Let's talk Ark of the Covenant and where it is.
Yeah, I saw this image and knew what it was immediately and said, all right, Stan is going to get into this tonight.
You bet. Now, I went to Google and looked up Temple Mount and got some pictures and stuff that I can talk to. I don't have them up on the screen, but it's the Temple Mount viewed from the southern wall. Now, the Wailing Wall is on the left or the west side of the Temple Mount, and you can see it in most photographs. It's down there where people are milling around. It's a little band, like a little length of a rectangular shape where the top of the wall is. But the actual Temple of Solomon was never rebuilt, and it was certainly not on the Temple Mount where the Dome of the Rock is and that kind of stuff. The Temple of Solomon was built a few hundred feet south of the Wailing Wall outside the Temple Mount foundation. Today, if you look at it, there's some little garden stuff planted right outside the Temple Mount foundation on the southwest corner.
Okay.
The old Temple of Solomon, the ruins of it are underneath there. And that there was a tunnel and a cave, like an opening, a cavern, where the five major artifacts of the Temple of Solomon were placed by King Josiah before they were even threatened with an invasion. He put it there for for safekeeping to the right or to the east side of the Temple Mount, down at the southeast corner. There's a lot of debris and stuff, which was probably part of the City of David. Outside the Temple Mount Foundation that people are talking about now, so it's outside that whole thing, and if we were to rebuild the Temple of Solomon in its proper place, it would be off of the Temple Mount Foundation entirely. And the research being put in by a number of researchers about this is such that we're seeing the location of it being in that area about five stories down, and it's not really been lost. It's just been hidden. One of the things that's interesting in this article that I linked to underneath that picture is this. The Levites, who were the priests in charge of, you know, guarding the temple artifacts and the temple itself in the wilderness, their lifespan was shorter than the average person's lifespan, because being close to the ark, the Aron HaKodesh, the radiation from it shortened their lifespan. And the members of the tribe of Levi were, you know, there was a smaller number of them per capita than, you know, elsewhere in the other 11 tribes, because they were exposed to this radiation. So if you look over at Eritrea, for instance, where they say they've got the Ark of the Covenant there in that place that's, you know, locked out for people to visit, there's one priest guy that watches over the Ark there. Well, he's an old guy with a beard. They lived a long time. If they were being exposed, as the Tanakh said, or, you know, as the old Jewish literature says, then he would have died young and been replaced by another a lot quicker than he is now. We're fairly certain that what he has looks like an Ark of the Covenant, but it's a copy made. And there were several copies of the five major artifacts of the temple made and distributed at the time to fool people who would try to get the real item. And I suspect that's what we saw on the carvings that showed Romans taking, you know, the candelabra in a box on, you know, two rods that could have been the Ark of the Covenant. They were probably taking duplicates, not the real deal, because we know that from Scripture that when the real deal was stolen by the Philistines, was it north of Israel there? Anyway, the pox came on them, and everybody got sick that came closer. And so they said, "Here, take it back. We don't want it." And you know, even the Jewish people that took the Ark of the Covenant that was being pulled by that ox on a cart, they had to stay clear of it. And one man, a Jewish man, saw that the ark was going to fall off because the cart was in a ditch, you know, as the ox was pulling it, and it was going to turn over. So he reached up to touch it and was instantly killed, you know, not because God was mad, but because it was a charged object and you're not supposed to mess with it. So this tells us that wherever it is, it's not in the public eye anywhere. I think it's still buried, as this guy says, down about four or five stories deep underneath the southwest corner of the Temple Mount. And, you know, in the southeast corner was Solomon's horse stables, you know, where you bucked out the horses and all that kind of stuff. You wouldn't think the Ark would be there. It'd have to be up where the temple was on the southwest corner. Anyway, the Ark, I think, was hidden there in about 586 B.C., as this article points out.
That's an interesting article, Stan. And there are many different stories, and you know, the Ark, as even the author points out, you know, many researchers, when studying the Ark, find themselves going to Ethiopia, you know, to look there. But he comes back, brings it back around, saying that to this very day, it is still under the Temple Mount, directly beneath the Holy of Holies, as you said, and that it's still there, and minus a war between with Israel, you would not, there's no reason to dig that up, they go on to say. But fascinating. I love Ark of the Covenant stuff. I mean, you talk about the inspiration for any and all treasure hunters. You know, that's the story right there, at least the story. The true story is much better, in my opinion, than just the treasure hunting story, but either way, yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
Well, Jewish legend or myth, whatever, does say that when the Ark of the Covenant is recovered, when the Messiah returns, that when it is brought to light, you know, above the surface, that it will actually recreate the temple of the wilderness. It will, the cloth and stuff that was there will become new again, and the posts that were holding up the cloth around the temple of the wilderness where the Holy of Holies was will renew. All the brass and copper and gold ornaments will renew, and it will function again as it was then. Remember, the Ark of the Covenant was one of two devices mentioned. One was there with the tribe of Israel in the Holy of Holies place, and the other was with God, God's Ark of the Covenant, which you can see references to in the Revelation of John. So these two things were an open communication, like almost a wormhole between God's dwelling and us here on the earth. And so messing with that is something that only people who know what they're doing should ever do. So amateur fortune hunters and stuff like that looking for it, even if they were allowed to get that close there, should be dissuaded from doing so. I did talk to one particular researcher, Ron Wyatt, who thought it was over at another place in Israel near the Skull Rock. But, you know, he said he'd gotten close enough that he could see with a little TV camera through a hole that it was there, and wanted to know how to approach it. And I told him, well, first of all, don't. But, you know, if you're insisting on it, be sure that, you know, you have a good electrical ground attached to you and out to, you know, a deep ground to a water well source, because the rumors are that there's extremely high voltage and radiation associated with it. You know, and I talked to Jonesy about that too, Bendel Jones, when we were talking about if we ever found it there in the caves, you know, how would we approach it, and how would we lay the grounding wires and shield ourselves, you know. And he even talked to a couple of rabbis there in Jerusalem about what they thought one should do if one discovered it or thought they had, and their advice was, you know, the same. Don't tell us where it is, but stay out of the way, and that people who are trained in this, you know, like Levite priests, let them do it, because they have to dress a certain way, they have to wear oil on their body in a certain way, they have to not lift their feet but drag their feet when they approach it to keep the potential from building up between their feet and killing them. All makes sense in physics, but that was the story about that. So I'm looking forward to seeing the Messiah, you know, myself. We're certainly getting close to that period of time here. I think that things will happen, and many of us will get to see him.
Yeah, many people think that, Stan, and especially after this last week, you know, we see a lot of, you know, prophecy brought up when we saw the two hurricanes there in the Atlantic, and then the earthquake, and then back to Harvey. With the increase in weather and stuff, we saw a lot of that, especially right after the eclipse and before this planetary alignment that's coming up on the 23rd. But either way, it will come when it comes, and we
True.
Can all hold
and
our
we'll be
head
doing
up
a show with
that.
You guys. We'll be doing your show on the 19th of this month, and possibly on the 26th if we're still here, right?
I'm going to be, yep, my calendar says I'll be here on the 26th, Dan, so barring an act of God, I'll be here.
Understood, understood. Yeah.
Yeah, we only got a few minutes left in this segment, Stan. I don't know if you heard us talk about this or not, but maybe you find this interesting. Lee Harvey Oswalt file turns up missing 1 month before supposed to be released to public. A declassified CIA record shows that one set, Volume 5, is missing. This was discovered by JFK researcher Malcolm Blunt. Says it's significant, and it was one of the CIA files on Oswalt. Now, by law, the U.S. government files on the assassination of Kennedy must be released by October 26, 2017, and that's all U.S. government files. Well, they just went back and looked, and one of the CIA's volumes of files on Lee Harvey Oswalt is now missing. Pretty
well,
interesting stuff.
I don't know why or who, but I also know that Lyndon Johnson, when he was president, he sealed up all the files he had on the assassination under presidential seal for 98 years, which means that it would be like something like 2067 before those could be released.
Yeah.
So. They're still, I mean, why are they being that picky about it, you know? I mean, let's say the truth. Everybody involved is probably dead now.
I don't know about now, but in that 40, 50 years, they will be. That's for sure.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, now, on our the show images page, let me just get back to it here. We've done that. Yeah. Okay. As with last week, I've got up the top, image 59. A lady sent this to me. It's a PDF you can download. It's only about one page, really. From Luke 21 through verses 25 to 28. I'm sure you probably already heard this, but I'll read it again for those that haven't. And there shall be signs in the sun, and in the moon, and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, and the sea and the waves roaring. Now, right there alone, we can see that we've had, a solar eclipse, all the sun and the moon, but the sun is acting up, and the pattern in the stars, in Revelation 12, we see that. Distress of nations, well, is that distress of genetic types or of physical nations? It doesn't matter. Both seem to work. And, of course, with the hurricanes and with earthquakes making the tidal waves occur and the waves from hurricanes sweeping over the land, you know, with the storm tides and things, surges. Anyway, going to the next verse, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Believe me, if you're one of the millions that have been impacted by losing your home and business and everything by these hurricanes, and not to mention what's coming with the earthquakes on the way, you can understand their fear because everything they held dear is gone, wiped out. Mm-hmm. Verse 27, and then they shall see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and glory after these things have occurred. And when these things begin to come to pass, look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draws near, it says. And, of course, as you see in the PDF, if you download it, it talks about the eclipse. And at the time they made this, there was only an X point, 9.3. But there's also an X 8.2 flare as well.
Yeah.
You can see.
And that's fascinating, Stan. And, you know, we do want to keep our eye on the spiritual time, the spiritual season that we're in, especially, with what we have coming up. We still got a lot of stuff coming up. A lot of people still expect, some high earthquake activities. They're keeping their eye on the sun. As you said, we got that asteroid coming up. So a lot of things to consider. And what's going on with North Korea? We got to talk about that at some point too. StanDeo.com. Stan and Holly Deo. I want to thank you both so much. Folks, go to StanDeo.com, bookmark the website, check out all the books and great content they got on their site. Stan, until next week, we'll see you then.
Lord willing, you bet. Bye-bye now.
Good night. All right, folks, that'll do it for us. Until tomorrow, stay safe, God bless, have a great night. We'll be back tomorrow.